'Twas on Good Friday morning, all on an April day, a German ship lay signaling beyond out in the bay. With 20,000 rifles all ready for to land, but no answering signal came from the lonely Bannerstrand.
The Lonely Bannerstrand, sung there by Sarah Conway, vividly narrates the failed landing of guns to support the 1916 Republicans and the capture and execution of Roger Casement. I'm Therese McIntyre, and in this week's episode of Hero Songs, I'm exploring ballads of protest in 1913 and those of the Rising in 1916, songs of Casement, James Connolly, and lockout leader Jim Larkin. Hero songs like this one, James Connolly, sung here by the Black family.
Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the Union, that working men they might yet be free.
And the Ballad of Jim Larkin, the leader of the workers during the lockout of 1913.
In Dublin City in 1913, the boss was boss, them employed the slave. The woman worked and the child went hungry, till Larkin came like a towering wave. The worker cringed when the boss man thundered, and 70 hours was their weekly chore. They asked for little and less was granted, lest getting little they might ask for more.
Francis Devine singing The Ballad of Jim Larkin, written by Donough McDonagh in 1963 for the 50th anniversary of the lockout. Now, folk music has long had a global connection with the workers' struggle, and there was an outpouring of ballads written during the emerging trade union and labour movement in Ireland. James Connolly, who was effectively Larkin's assistant during the lockout, wrote songs himself. I went to Liberty Hall in Dublin to ask labour historian and singer Francis Devine why songs became so important during this time.
I think songs were popular at the time because, in the absence of what we would experience today, of television, radio, etc., an awful lot of entertainment took place either in the homes or in the street or in courtyards, and people sang. And it's pretty obvious from attendances at things like music hall and so on that songs were very popular. In the case of the labour movement, there was a tradition, which I think predates 1913, of people singing songs often to music hall tunes or traditional airs. Sometimes, and this was the great strength of the Irish worker, they would diminish the status of the good and the great by parody or by lampooning or by poking fun. The ballads and songs, the poems, the squibs in the Irish Worker, which incidentally was read by 100,000 people a month, 20,000 a week, and at the top of the Irish Worker, it often encouraged readers, when you've read it, pass it on. So the readership was very significant. Now, there were problems with literacy in some quarters, so you can sort of imagine, particularly the poems and the songs, that they would have been performed in tenements and in pubs and so on, and that appears to be the case. For example, at the end of the Wexford lockout in January, February 1912, Connolly wrote We Are Freedom's Pioneers to the air of We Are the Boys of Wexford.
Our proudest boast in labour's host were freedom's pioneers.
And it was sung the night the dispute ended in victory for the workers, and within weeks was, in sheet music terms, in today's parlance, a number one hit, and was sung around the city. He also wrote The Watchword of Labour, the music of which was provided by Seamus Hughes, J.J. Hughes, later a director of Radio Éireann.
The watchword of labour, the slogan of those who'd be free.
And that became again a ballad and an anthem that was sung and remains the anthem of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union / SIPTU. So songs and poetry and even the text of plays that appeared in the Irish Worker were obviously, you know, sung around the city, and there's evidence from the time of Lark and Squibs being sung by kids as skipping rhymes or as taunts to scabs or as taunts to the police.
Then send it aloft on the breeze, boys, that watchword the grandest we've known, that labour must rise from its knees, boys, and claim the broad earth as its own.
Francis Devine there on the power of songs to mobilise, and singer Michael Gallen performing James Connolly's songs Freedom's Pioneers and the Watchword of Labour. Jim Larkin, a Liverpool man, gained his reputation as a trade union leader during the Belfast strike of 1907 and established the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. James Connolly, a Scottish-born socialist, became his key aide-de-camp in the events leading to the 1913 lockout, when Dublin employers led by William Martin Murphy take on the union.
To manhood for freedom take stand, then send it aloft on the breeze.
Horry Gates is an author and expert on the period.
This was one where it was really workers on one side, employers on the other. And if Jim Larkin's great achievement was to unite workers in the belief they could actually win better conditions, William Martin Murphy's achievement was to unite employers, Catholic and Protestant, that they could beat the other side. So it was, to some extent, a battle of personalities, but they very much personified those camps of labour and capital. Larkin was Liverpool Irish. His parents were children of a diaspora. They were from County Armagh. They met on the emigrant boat to Liverpool. They stayed in Liverpool. He left school at 14, which was the normal age at that time. He worked in various jobs. He became a socialist very early in life, and as early as school, really. So when he came out of prison, he decided to set up his own union, the Transport Union, in 1909, and the core of that union became Dublin. And the battle there was to get decent pay and conditions for the members who were unskilled workers. Dublin had more unskilled workers than any other city on these islands. Over a quarter of all adult males over the age of 14 were unskilled workers. They were dockers, building labourers, messengers, carters, various jobs.
Where, oh, where can that gallant man be?
Well, I mean, that's one of the ironies of Irish labour history, that the two founding fathers were both actually born in Britain. Connolly was born in Leith in Edinburgh. There's a few mysteries about Connolly's early life, particularly his time in the British Army. He never spoke about it. Whatever the experience was, it engendered a very bitter hatred of everything the British Army stood for. And very unusually, he again was a mixed marriage. He married Lily Reynolds, who was from Wicklow. She was a poor Protestant working as a domestic servant when he was stationed in Dublin. And he was a member of the Liverpool Regiment, which was a sort of an Irish regiment, or people of Irish descent tended to join it. But for some reason, he was nearly at the end of his term of service, and he left, he deserted, to marry her. They didn't work well together. They're often rowed with each other, although they shared the same political objectives. They were very different. Connolly was a brilliant polemicist, writer, propagandist. He was a very fine speaker, not as good as Larkin. But, I mean, Larkin could talk rubbish and the crowd would still be swayed. Larkin's primary skill as an orator was to connect psychologically with the crowd. It's a bit like sort of Adolf Hitler, if you like. It's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Ask them for your rights! And they'll see you go jobless first and your children starve. They did it to those men. And tomorrow, if you let them, they'll do it to you.
And he had this amazing capacity. I mean, my father would have heard Larkin speak. And he had this huge voice, it's like an opera singer, a powerful voice that could project over a crowd. I think someone who listened to him compared him to Shelley Appin, the great Russian bass singer. And he had that sort of powerful voice.
They know I'm here to ask you to do something that's greater than their power.
In Dublin City in 1913, the boss was rich and the workers slaves. The women working, the children starving. Along came Larkin like a mighty wave.
Peter O'Toole as the voice of Jim Larkin in Strumpet City, the TV drama from Jim Plunkett's book, and Porrig Yates on the background to the events. You're listening to Francis Devine and the Ballad of Jim Larkin. It's perhaps the best known of the many Larkin ballads and was composed by Donough McDonough, the son of the executed 1916 leader Tomás McDonough. McDonough was asked by the Irish Congress of Trade Unions to write something for the 50th anniversary, and the play Let Freedom Ring was born with a few verses in it.
Then came Larkin in 1913, a mighty man with a powerful tongue, the voice of labour, the voice of justice, and he was gifted, and he was young. God gave us Larkin in 19...
Here's Francis Devine on the song, which links the events of 1913 and 1916.
And when I sing that song today, I am much more conscious of having some sort of connection back to the men, women and children of 1913, the tenement dwellers, the slum dwellers, and the sheer physical, political, moral courage that they demonstrated against huge odds. So I think for a lot of Dubliners in particular singing that song today, you're reconnecting back through the generations, and that is a magnificent tribute to the writer of the song. I think when people sing it or hear it sung, they feel good afterwards. What is the purpose of a hero ballad from a class point of view? It is to make people feel better, to feel energised, to believe in struggle. And in that sense, politically, this song is a magnificent song. As a socialist or as an organiser, this song takes some beating.
They shot our leaders, the harp was shattered beneath the crown. They shot McDermott and Pearse and Plunkett. They shot McDonough and Clark the Brave. From bleak Kilmainham they took Kant's body to...
This is a hero ballad written after the man has died. The second thing about this ballad is it does link 1913 into 1916.
Labour, the voice of justice, he gave his life that we might be free.
So while the McDonough ballad is about Larkin and the lockout, its climax is the execution of the 1916 leaders, including Connolly, at Kilmainham Jail.
Where, oh, where is our James Connolly?
Both the ballad of Jim Larkin and the song Where, oh, where is our James Connolly were written long after the events and impose a direct link between 1913 and 1916 that historians often challenge. The Connolly song dates from the 50s and is by Patrick Galvin, and we're listening now to Galvin himself, singing it in New York in 1981.
Where, oh, where is the citizen army?
Then who will lead the vow?
And then to the Black Family version, with Marion Francis Black on
then
vocals.
Then who will lead the van? Who bought our James Connolly? The hero of the working man.
I asked Frances Black to share her memories of that recording.
Something very magical happened when we recorded that song, and something still magically happens when we sing it as a family. There's the voices of the lads on it when they come in and sing on the harmonies. You can really hear the passion in it. I suppose that's the only way you can describe it. And we all love singing it. And it brings back James Connolly's memory. It brings back his memory every time we sing it. And it's something that I feel very passionate about. It's very important that we keep his memory alive. I mean, I think it was James Connolly who was in the wheelchair when they did shoot him. I think that for me, again, come back to when I was 11 or 12 and I went to Kilmainham Jail with the school just as a tour. And I remember them talking about that and talking about James Connolly being brought out in his wheelchair. He had already been shot, you know, and they shot him in his wheelchair. I mean, how awful was that?
They carried him up to the jail and they shot him down on a bright May morning.
I suppose when you think of the words of this song, you know, and the grief and the pining for this man who really wanted to help us, our people, back in 1913 to 1916. The very first line, which is, where, oh, where is our James Connolly? I mean, where, oh, where is that gallant man? And what a gallant man he was. And he's gone to organise the union. But the bit that I love is when, then who will lead the van? Then who will lead the van? Who but our James Connolly, the hero of the working man? I love that verse.
Where, oh, where is
is our James Connolly. Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the Union, that working men they might yet be free.
Francis Black and the Black Family with the ballad James Connolly.
Some men faint-hearted ever seek our programme to retouch, and will insist whene'er they speak that we demand too much.
We're listening now to Michael Gallen singing one of Connolly's own songs, We Only Want the Earth, written over 100 years ago.
For our demands most moderate are, we only want the earth.
But if the more recent ballads frame the workers' struggle in the lockout as a precursor to the 1916 rising, it's not a link that historian Dermot Farrador agrees with.
There is not, I think it's fair to say, a direct link between the lockout of 1913 and the rising of 1916. That would be a misreading of history. There's nothing to suggest in 1913 or at the end of the lockout of 1913 that this is going to lead logically on to the 1916 rising. Far from it. What you have at the end of the lockout is a degree of hurt, of disillusionment, of despair about what the future will hold for those who are advocating a workers' republic. But what you also have is the creation of the Irish Citizens' Army. But the transition from that to supporting the rising of 1916 is one that's intriguing and one that would have caused surprise to some of James Connolly's contemporaries. But they also would have seen within James Connolly the growing disillusionment, the idea that ultimately those impulses that were at work within the labour movement were going to be dwarfed by republicanism and by nationalism until that republican and nationalist question was solved.
So if we're looking for a sharper sense of the time itself, the contemporary ballads bring us closer not just to the events, but to the people themselves and to Connolly and Larkin.
Who fears to wear the red hand badge upon his manly breast? What scab obeys the vile command of Murphy and the rest?
The song Who Fears to Wear the Red Hand Badge, written in October 1913 by Andrew Patrick Wilson, captures the Union battle far more vividly. And it's one Francis Devine has, in many ways, made his own.
The badge with us.
The Red Hand Badge is the quintessential iconographic emblem of 1913. It was the Union's badge. It was a disembodied red hand with the letters ITW and the year 1913 on it. It was introduced in January and almost immediately seized the public imagination. Now, a lot of the songs in The Irish Worker were written to existing tunes, but were written for a purpose. And in this one, again, if you think it was written in October, was written to raise morale. And of course, the final thing about the badge was the issue of the strike was effectively about recognition of a union, the right to be in a union. And you expressed that right in those days by wearing your badge. So this is an invocation to the rank and file, as it were, to wear their badge with pride.
We found in Jim a heart to blaze, to break down unjust laws. But 'tis a sin to follow Jim, says Murphy and his crew. But true men like you men will stick to him like glue.
It is one of the hero ballads. I mean, Jim is the hero of the ballad, so it's one of those songs in praise of the leader. But I think it actually is a bit wider than that, and I think the key line in it is at the start of the third verse, where he says, we rose in sad and weary days. I think there were sad and weary days, but they rose to fight the workers' cause, and they found in Jim a heart ablaze to break down unjust laws. So it's a praise of themselves as much as Larkin.
And true Jim, our own Jim, will win our fight today.
Francis Devine. After the defeat of the workers in early 1914, Larkin went to the United States. By 1915, Europe was in the midst of the bloodshed of World War I. Thousands of Irish joined the British forces to fight and die. James Connolly, horrified by the image of so many dying for the crown, moved closer to the Republicans planning an armed uprising, seeing the war as an opportunity to strike. I went to meet Connolly's great-grandson, James Connolly Heron, at the house on Henry Street, the last base for the 1916 rebels.
It was in these houses that five of the signatories to our Proclamation of Independence spent their last hours of freedom before their execution, one of whom was my great-grandfather. He had been wounded twice, once in the arm, which he hid from the garrison and the GPO, and then he was wounded in the ankle in Abbey Street and crawled his way back up to the GPO. So he spent the rest of the time on a stretcher in the General Post Office. But he was still in command, and Pierce's last communique, he referred to James Connolly and said he's still the guiding brain of our resistance. Lilly had always held out the hope that because he had been wounded during the course of the fighting, that they wouldn't execute a wounded prisoner. He himself, I think, knew his fate.
Over at the Connolly statue, just beside Liberty Hall, I caught up with Lorcan Collins, who runs 1916 walking tours in Dublin.
The memorial went up on the 80th anniversary of James Connolly's execution. So the flag that you can make out there is, of course, the Starry Plough. The idea behind the flag is it's the workers' flag, it's the Irish Citizen Army flag. The stars represent socialism, and the plough represents the constellation in the sky, of course, but also the dignity of physical labour. There's also that lovely phrase, the cause of labour is the cause of Ireland, and the cause of Ireland is the cause of labour. I think there's a lot of people go by here and sometimes stop and reflect on James Connolly. And if you look at his left leg, which is sticking out, you'll see it's rubbed clean by people just passing by. They veer just a little bit to the right and come over and just give Connolly a little pat on the leg. I think that's a very significant gesture altogether.
Bury me in Ireland, implored Roger Casey. Now, his last wish was granted nearly 49 years after his execution in England on a charge of high treason.
While Connolly and those who signed the 1916 proclamation were shot in Kilmainham Jail, the character of our final hero song, Roger Casement, was hanged in Pentonville Prison in England as a traitor and stripped of his knighthood. In 1965, Casement was reburied in a state funeral.
The court paused for 1 minute at the post office, where the Republic was proclaimed in the uprising of Easter 1916. Glasnevin Cemetery was the chosen burial place.
Casement, an Irish-born British diplomat, enlisted German support to ship arms into Ireland in advance of the Easter Rising, but was arrested at Bannastrand.
Good Friday morning, all on an April day, a German ship lay signalling beyond out in the bay with 20,000 rifles all ready for to land. But no answering signal came from the lonely Bannastrand.
As a British consul, Casement had championed human rights in Peru and the Congo. He retired in 1913 and helped form the Irish Volunteers, becoming increasingly committed to the Irish Republican cause. Lorcan Collins.
He dedicated himself to the Irish language, he dedicated himself to the Irish Volunteers, he helped out with the Fianna as well, and he was the logical choice to be sent over to Berlin to negotiate some form of an arms shipment to Ireland in 1916. Ideas they're going to drop down onto the southwest coast of Ireland in County Kerry and land the weapons, hopefully, on Easter Saturday 1916, and the next day, Easter Sunday, would be the uprising. That's the general plan. Furthermore, Roger Casement arrived on shore, if you will, and within a couple of hours he was arrested by the Royal Irish Constabulary, the RIC.
I am Roger Casement. I have come to my native land. I mean to free my countrymen
on the lonely Bannistrand.
Sarah Conway with the ballad The Lonely Bannistrand. We don't know who wrote it or exactly when it's written. Derek Warfield of the Wolftones wrote a final verse for the song in 1965 when Casement's Remains returned.
I always say, and I say it on stage, that the songs are our monuments to our fallen heroes and patriots and our way of life. Other nations across Europe could express their patriotism and their nationality and their identity through wonderful palaces, through monarchies, and through great institutions. But we can never do that in Ireland. Our monuments are in our music, they're in our songs, they're in our ballads, and the ordinary people place them as gods.
Now they took Sir Roger home again in the year of 65, and with his comrades of 16, in peace and tranquil lies, his last fond wish it is fulfilled, for to lie in his native land, and the waves will roll in peace again on the lonely Bannistrand.
Derek Warfield there and his final verse to Bannistrand. For Lorcan Collins, the songs of Larkin, Connolly and Casement are not history, but ways of connecting with our past.
Larkin and Connolly and Roger Casement in song, although never very accurate, there's a certain beauty about the fact that most Irish people know a few lines of some of those songs. So if songs are there to help remember the past and to remember our history, whether or not they're perfectly accurate shouldn't really bother us too much. If it prompts somebody to look into that character a little bit more and try and find out a little bit of facts about him, well, you know, it's not a bad thing, is it? And by the same token, if poets are allowed to do it, songwriters must also be allowed a little bit of poetic license.
Lorcan Collins. Next week, we're in the War of Independence and the story of Kevin Barry, sung here by Paul Robeson.
Joy jail, one Monday morning, high upon the gallows tree, Kevin Barry gave his young life for the cause.